Clippers.
Let's just not stay here a lot over.
Welcome, we'll start the Senate Environmental Natural Resource Committee will come to order.
Nice is that what this is?
Tuesday, February 28, 2012.
It's good to be seen because the alternative.
Senator Kelash.
Can we get a trial?
Just kidding.
This guy's been biking.
You two guys. Your bad news. Welcome, members and folks in the crowd, and some testifiers here. We're going to have a presentation from the mountain biking trail in the Cuyuna County State Recreation Area. This is an area, folks, that some of you may or may not remember. We did make a short trip up there earlier this year, and you know, they say we got to travel all over the country to see. Some beautiful area, and quite frankly, we don't have to go that far. That was very stunning, very beautiful. And today we're going to have a little presentation on the trail up there, which I still think is quite challenging, to say the very least. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this bike before you, the big tires, in case you wanted to know, is actually truly for winter biking. And I saw it parked up in my office before I came down, and I thought, wow, somebody brought me a gift. But not to be. But I don't want to waste any more time so that they have plenty of time here. But this is Chris Rutgers from Rutgers Resort. Are you the third or fourth generation?
Fourth
generation of that family-run resort up on Bay Lake. If you haven't been there, you need to go there. And then Jenny Smith from the name of the bike business?
Cycle, Path, and Paddle. Cycle.
Cycle.
And
Cyclepath. Okay, got it.
So I'm gonna turn the program over to them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Again,
thank you
welcome.
So much.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As he said, my name is Jenny Smith. I own a small business. I do sales and rentals of silent sports equipment. I'm also the current vice chair of the Cuyuna Lakes Trail Association. I've been involved with that group since 2000. And first of all, I'd like to thank you for your past support of the Cuyuna Lakes Trail and ask for your support for Senate File 1873 with the bonding bill. And that money would go to extending the current Cuyuna Lakes Trail from where it ends now down to the Sagamore unit of the Cuyuna Country State Recreation Area. And that is where the new 10 miles of fat tire biking trails are. They'll also be used during the summer, though, for regular mountain biking. The trail will also extend from Crosby to the city of Deerwood. This is of significance since the majority of our lodging is in Deerwood at the current time. It's also heading down towards Bay Lake and to Chris's resort. The other thing that I want to mention, the Cuyuna Lakes Trail with those extensions really becomes the ribbon that ties the whole package, the communities of Riverton, Ironton, Cuyuna, and Crosby, and Deerwood, and the two sections of the Cuyuna Lakes Mountain Bike Trail. Ties that all into a really neat package, so it becomes all one complete system. With the opening of the mountain bike trails last summer, it really was an amazing thing for my business. I opened my business in 2005, and of course the first 2 years are always a struggle, but then the economy tanked in 2008, and then it really became a challenge to keep my doors open. Last year I saw an increase in bike rentals of nearly 300%. And as a result of the trails, I will be more than doubling my mountain bike rentals, my bike rentals, road and mountain bikes this summer, also increasing my canoe and kayaks rentals, because we've seen an increase in that as well. And I can truly say that without the investment in the mountain bike trails and the development of those trails, I probably would have closed my doors as of last year. I've just seen it's been that significant a change for me. I've been focusing a lot on getting women and youth into the mountain biking, and that's I've been doing a women's only mountain bike group on Wednesday nights. But I have to say my greatest joy is when I am out there riding, either on the paved trail or the mountain bike trails, and I see multi-generations. I see the little 2-year-olds on their Strider bikes out there with mom or dad along with grandpas and grandmas. You see it all the time. little kids on up to 80-year-olds out enjoying the trails and enjoying the rec area. And I invite you all to come on up. It really is a very unique and special place. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Chris Rutger. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Mr. Rutger.
Thank you, Chair and members. I'm Chris Rutger from Rutgers Bay Lake Lodge. And I represent not a new business, but a business that's been there for generations, and my great-grandparents started it in the 1800s. And it seems as if it's probably since they started it, it's been a constant learning process and reinventing ourselves every few years. They started out with fishing. Eventually, golf came along in the 20s, and then sometimes water skiing and even funny hat night in the dining room. I mean, it's been everything you can imagine through the years. It's reinventing yourself, figuring out what your guests need. The guests of 1900 weren't the same as the guests today. And so it's kind of interesting now at the time, as Jenny mentioned, when the economy is kind of cracking down on everybody, and families who vacation have to tighten their belts, businesses who have meetings at places like ours have to limit the size of their meetings or even not have meetings. And so now it's, I think, another reinvention. It's kind of cool at this time to see a world-class mountain bike trail turn up right in our backyard, and that's thanks to some very hard-working people and some help from folks here. A beautiful scenic paved trail taking shape right in our neighborhood. We have a beautiful trail now, and this all plays into what we do. It's new outdoor activities that are good for people of all ages, and we've had family business for many years, family reunions, but they're looking for options. They have younger members, and not necessarily just younger members, something fun to do, mountain biking. Also, business groups that we have, sort of team-building events or just adventure things, as Jenny was talking about, adventure outings that we've had. So this is a very exciting time. Our resort is in the Cuyuna Lakes region. It's not right at the trails, but still very, very close enough that it's very useful to us, and it's already had an impact. With the help of some folks, we're working on making our place more cycle-friendly, reinventing ourselves again. We've even looked into possibly developing a beginner little mountain bike trail right on our property, which would be a fun thing for families to try out before they head out to the big trails. And we really hope to see the Cuyuna Lakes Trail connect someday to our resort and to the other paved trails in our area, and that's on our horizon, I think. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
A couple other members that want to present.
Mr. Johnson, is that correct? Mrs. Johnson.
Yes.
And Aaron Hatala?
Correct.
Finlander.
Yes.
Not too bad for them. Johnson was easy.
Yes. Well, you might have
heard a lot. Mrs. thing, I didn't do very well with that. But
It might be due to my first name, Mr. Chair, and members of the chamber. My name is Jonna Johnson. It's Jonna. Easy to do that.
Right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My job is at the Chamber of Commerce in the Cuyuna Lakes area. I've been there for 8 years, and what I can tell you is about when I started 8 years ago, there was 93 chamber members. Today there's over 200, which is a great great growth that we've had. That's not directly related to the mountain bike trails or to the trails in specific, but it is related to investment to our community. What's better than having 200-plus chamber members is having 200 happy chamber members, which at the Bike Summit earlier this year, I was able to introduce myself as Jonna Johnson from the Cuyuna Lakes Chamber, the happiest chamber in the state of Minnesota. And that is due to the gift that's been given to our community. I'm here to speak specifically as to what has happened to the businesses in our area. And I can tell you about the dollars that they've the percentage is that they've grown or the dollars that they've made, but really the best thing that I've seen is the hope. 2008 was hard on every community, but if you look at Crosby, Ironton specifically, we've had hard time after hard time after hard time. So hitting another economic downturn was really destroying a lot of our businesses. So we kept talking about these mountain bike trails. We're going to get them. They're going to be here. They're coming. And there was all kinds of speculation of what that means. We foolishly believed that mountain bike trails meant we were going to get a bunch of adrenaline drunk junkies, 30-year-old males, and the only people who were going to profit were the hospitals and the bars. Thankfully, we had people like Gary Schoquist who came into town about a year ago. He started telling us, no, trust me, this is going to mean a lot to your community. This is going to be a game changer. And I hesitated giving you some of these visual aids prior to talking because they're really stunning. And I think what you can see is I have the Midwest Living magazine right here in my hands. Without any effort on anybody's part in our community, we got listed as one of the top places for fun. Ironton, Minnesota got top. The other one is the Mountain Bike Action, which you will see is absolutely stunning. That's a eight-page article in their December issue. So we wanted you to see these. I'll be honest, without someone in our community actually getting Midwest Living, we wouldn't have known that Minnesota, and Ironton specifically, was listed in Midwest Living. So we're very excited, and we don't know what else is out there. I can tell you one of the blogs, Get Fit with Jane, a Minnesota blogger, and she wrote about the courage that our community has to create an area that is allowing her grandson to understand fitness. Now, I don't think, again, we talked about mountain bikers and what they're going to bring to our community, and this is what they're going to do. We didn't talk about fitness. We didn't talk about multi-generation, but this is what we got, and the byproduct is an 8-page spread, a Midwest Living, and you also have the Wall Street Journal that listed us. So those were some major national accreditations that came, but they didn't come because we're a new area. They came because we're a really, really well-done area. And you'll see that with the issue sheet that we created, we really wanted to make sure that you understand the world-class, the nature of these being the highest standard that could ever happen with the mountain bike trails. And what that has translated into is 15,000 bikers into our community. And if you can visualize a bar graph, 15,000 new riders to our community. We have a baseline in 1 year of 15,000. That pie or that bar graph is only going to grow from here forward. So I hope with your investment, you'll continue to watch that grow with us. I'd like to say that we'll have 100,000 in the next 10 years. And what will that do for our businesses? It'll create jobs, and it'll get our community who has had hard time after hard time after hard time to be looked at as a really shining example in the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Johnson, if I could ask, international interest at all? Did you mention something about that?
Yes, well, the Wall Street Journal, again, these are publications that are citing us without any reference. We're not soliciting them to talk about us. So somehow the buzz is out there. Obviously, Wall Street Journal, Midwest Living, and this, the Mountain Bike Action, Mountain Bike Action, these were people from California. So this expert writer that came here with his photos all over in this article lives in California. He flew here to ride these trails and to write this article.
Well, that certainly is a different country. There's no question about that. Members, any questions at all? Go ahead.
That's okay. I just want to introduce Aaron Hautzla. He's the one that designed this piece here. This is our new visitor guide. It just got in our hands Friday. We wanted to rush it to make sure that we could present it to you. Aaron's been working very hard on how we can rebrand our community with a lot of other people in our town. We want to create the new model of tourism that's been created for us. Now how can we attract them with a good marriage of the traditional trout fishing and mountain biking? How can we make that work? So this is what that piece is dedicated to.
Very good. So this fell on our eyes first then, is that correct?
Pardon?
It fell on our eyes first then?
Is yeah, that you. I'll tell you the truth. I went to the City Crosby Council last night, and you guys, the advertisers haven't even seen it yet. Yes, Aaron? Sorry.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Aaron Hautzla, and I'm honored actually to be here, number one, but number two, to be the president of the Kaino Lakes Mountain Bike Crew. And yes, that is my bike, so I'll get to that later. But the Mountain Bike Crew is a group of community members in the Crosby area, the Brainerd area, And our goal is to be the steward of the mountain bike trails. A lot of that makes it, you know, assumption would be, okay, we take care of the trails, or we make new trails, or we just go out and ride them and have a lot of fun. Yes, that's part of it. But what this new board is coming to the table is really trying to figure out, how do we turn these trails into an economic stimulator for the area that continues to bring the people in, but pumps money into the local economy so Jenny's business grows. A new business who's considering coming. And we as a mountain bike community who love riding fully understand that we do have to increase an economy in our local area, and we're passionate about doing it. And I'm going to talk just real quickly a lot about that. But the state gave us a gift. John has said it. These trails are a gift like no other. It's our responsibility and duty to go after it. And our goal really isn't just to get expert riders. You're going to see a lot of expert riders in this clip. We want families. We want people that have never ridden before coming to this. We have to approach everybody to be on this because we need everybody to want it. Not just people in Minnesota. We need Wisconsin. We need any state that touches Minnesota. We want Canada. We want international, because this is an international destination. Jordan Vandal, our vice president of the crew, who's right over here, he's currently working on a pump track in Cuyuna. And what you need to know about the pump track that's so cool is right now there's kids that don't even ride and don't even think they like riding, but when that pump track comes out, these kids are going to live for riding. Because it's built to go after kids. It's built to get people that aren't in the industry or aren't doing the biking right now to bike. And with these trails, we're going to get kids that had never been out on a bike, out on the bike, enjoying the land of Minnesota and getting active and fit during it. And that will bring people, that will bring dollars to the area. John had touched on it. We were the first appointed ride center in the nation. Minnesota was the first ride center in the nation. And that was a huge compliment for what these trails are. Currently, we have the Cuyuna Mojo, I call it, where the entire country's looking to the middle of Minnesota saying, what's going on there? What are they doing? And we want to build on that. John had also said we had 15,500 riders in the first year, but this mountain bike crew is convinced that's not good enough. We have to bring double that, because you guys know it's all about numbers. The more numbers you have, the more economy you have. And we went to the DNR with this idea of, okay, how do we get more riders? How can we extend our season through the winter? And the DNR came back with another gift saying, okay, we approved 10 miles of winter trails. So we now have 10 miles of winter trail. And what you're seeing behind me right now, perfect timing, is winter riding, which is going to be a huge event this weekend. Friday, Saturday, we're going to have the first Cuyuna Lakes Whiteout. And it's attracting people from Minnesota, from Wisconsin. We have a guy flying in from Germany to be in a race. We have the eyes of the mountain bike world looking at Minnesota right now. And we have the opportunity to capitalize on this if we want to. And we're going to, because we need to. Because we need to bring jobs, we need to bring dollars, and we need to increase the revenue of the Cuyuna Lakes. And not just the Cuyuna Lakes, but Crow Wing County as a whole, and Minnesota as the final game. That's really our goal. We want to have fun mountain biking, but we really want to position this state as high as we can. So let's see what else. I think that really capitalizes a lot what I wanted to say. But what we have to walk away from this is to say, number one, thank you that we even have these trails. But number two, how can we as the local kids, you know, up in Cuyuna, what can we do to keep positioning this investment? And what can we do down here to keep investing in this community, in these trails, and really this lifestyle? Because it's not just something you do on the weekend. Once you start biking, it takes over your life, and it takes over in a good way. It just controls how you want to do things and makes you feel active and gets you out there, and you're out with other fellow riders, and it's a community like no other. So what can we do together as the state of Minnesota to position Minnesota as the capital of outdoor adventure lifestyle in this country? That's kind of the mantra we're going after. We don't want to just be great in Crow Wing County. We want to be great within the state and great within the country. And that's my story.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly love the enthusiasm. There's no question at all. Members, any questions? Senator Kelech.
Just a quick question. Quite frankly, I hadn't heard of snow biking before, and I'm just wondering, where's the sport kind of developed, and the industry and the fat tires and all of that stuff? And can you just talk a little bit about that, and the opportunities, and maybe trying to develop that a little
bit? Mr. Chair and Senator, it originated in Alaska. because they have a lot of snow year-round. So they developed the tires first so that they could transport back and forth. It has now, thanks to QBP, Salsa, and Surly, they've really made it mainstream now, where these bikes are coming around and they're becoming kind of like a normal bike. You still get a lot of reaction to it. Wow, what's that? But the state of Minnesota has really jumped onto this to promote winter biking. We've jumped onto it to be an economic driver.
Thanks.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't help but notice when we were talking earlier about is this only going to bring in 30-year-olds and have anything to do with the healthcare facilities and the bars, I couldn't help but notice you have Surly Fat Tires.
Double duty, huh? Was there a question?
Yeah.
Certainly do see the snow tire. You were going to explain this bike for us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator. This bike, it has a 4.7-inch tire. And what you're seeing behind me, when you're riding on snow, you need some float. And basically, you have, it sounds crazy, but you have about 5 to 8 pounds of pressure in your tires so that the tire compresses and allows you to ride and maintain your balance. And what you wouldn't think to be normal is that you can actually come down a hill just about as fast as you want. And the faster you go, the more better chance that you're actually going to make the corner. I learned to try to, you know, take it slow. I didn't want to get hurt, you know, but I was going slow enough that I couldn't turn. Mm-hmm. And you need to go at a good pace just so you can make the turn. And now we have folks that can ride year-round. I get to exercise year-round with a winter bike, and that's the best possible scenario for myself. And ideally, you know, this is an early adoption right now in Cuyuna, but next year, this time in Cuyuna, you're going to see a lot of these bikes. And then you'll see kids on these bikes. And then that concept of winter biking will be the new default.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you heard him say it. You have a chance of making the corner.
You can never guarantee anything.
That was going to be my next question. Was going to be directed to Senator Gazelka. How many miles in the wintertime are you going to be traveling on these trails?
Not many, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions from the committee? I did see one area here that in my other life, we sent divers up there for practice diving, and I remember them coming back saying how stunning it is to dive in those pits there where the fish were just kind of lingering, and the bigger pike were laying in the background, and I know there's certainly some good fishing opportunities up there for pretty good sized fish, and it's something for the members to really see. It really is beautiful. We really appreciate the presentation. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senators.
Mr. Chair, they come from all over to do diving in that lake, too, don't they? Which is, I don't know, what is it, 200 feet deep or 300 feet deep or something? 400 feet deep. And they were telling us about that when we were there. So that's bringing some people in also.
We really have a great marriage of the traditional golf fishing, and we're finding that they like to come for fishing. We have regional, it's not just Rutgers and our local hotels that are staying. We have people from Brainerd, Pequot Lakes. They're coming, but they're staying longer. So they're coming for what they used to come for, but now they're discovering what kind it has to offer, and they're staying longer, which is a really great benefit.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. Senator Gazelka, anything further you'd like to add? Or?
No, I just want to encourage your support of their proposal.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You may need those snow tires for the drive home.
Hey, I'm glad I have it.
Yeah.
You might see me going up I-94 with those later.
Members, we have three bills here, actually, to finish the day off. Mine is going to be first, so Senator...
Lake up there.
So
and it's clear. I guess just about hits the bottom.
All the way down.
Yeah, and the divers are starting to come in from all over the place. So they got something going on there. Huh? Oh, yeah.
Turn that off, I said.
What's that? We funded the trail, and then we funded the park there. They cut you in a park. And that's where they do the diving. And
hey, Mr. Chair and members.
Oh, just
Senator Gabretsen.
Just recently.
I have before you Senate File 1839, which is an agency bill from the DNR. Miscellaneous Natural Resource Provision Modification. With me today, Bob Meyer from the DNR. Got some handouts here, I guess somebody can help him with that. And Mr. Chair, before moving forward, I do have a A1 delete all, delete everything.
Okay.
That I would like to have adopted.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, who's the A1 amendment? Everybody has that?
Must have been a bad bill to be in there. Ingebrigtsen.
As an author's amendment, we'll just move that. All in favor of the 1839 A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Ayes have it. Proceed, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And bear with me a little bit here. This is kind of noisy, this machine here yet. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Myers to get rid of the noise for me. And thank you. And he will take it from here.
Mr. Myers. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I'm handing around our fact sheet that was drafted to the bill as it was introduced. There are a few things I think that are missing from the DE amendment that I can just touch on briefly. But basically, this is a Department of Natural Resources omnibus policy and natural resources bill. It does contain also the land sales pieces that I believe we'll be traveling separately in another bill. We can touch on those briefly in here, so we don't need to go over those again. Also, Mr. Chairman and members, we have discussed portions of this bill as they relate to the aquatic invasive species sections of the bill, and I will just briefly touch on those. So to the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, Section 1 allows us for dealing with funds from Outdoor Heritage and other funds that we would be able to provide short-term cash flow advances under executed grants or contracts, positions to help with those closings, make sure they happen in a timely fashion. Section 2 is a report repeal from the Forest for the Future program. Section 3 relates to a recruitment retention program within Parks and Trails, specifically the Trails Division, for our motorized activities called, we're going to kind of call it an I Can Ride program, but really it would allow a person that would be required otherwise to have a training safety certificate to participate in an event sponsored within the state parks. So you can see that the person must be accompanied by an adult with a valid safety certificate, lines 2.8 and then 2.9. The vehicles must be registered in Minnesota. Section 4 is the beginning of several different pieces relating to a very technical change within the statutes. You can see on lines 2.27, this is dealing with snowmobiles. We're striking the word the and inserting a. So previously, people were confused that if you were ticketed and found guilty of a violation on a snowmobile that prohibited you from using a snowmobile, the statute said the snowmobile. So, you know, I got arrested on this snowmobile, but I want to ride this one. So we're just clarifying that that's not the case for people. So moving forward, Section 5 on page 3, service provider. This is related to our aquatic invasive species provisions, and this is where we're going to kind of get sidetracked from the fact sheet because of the sections and the numbering. You can see that this would require that service provider. It's a technical change that was actually brought to us by one of our stakeholders from being falling under the requirements of a lake service provider if you're a member of a yacht club, boat club, marina, or a similar organization. You would get pulled into that. Section 6, you can see, is again related to our VHS or AIS provisions, talking about specifically authorized under a permit to remove aquatic plants. So this is just a technical change there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Kelash.
I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to review the delete all, but one of the concerns I had in the original bill, and maybe it's all gone here, Mr. Meyer, but were some of the, on the invasive species, the regulations on how long you could keep a stop people and all of that. Is that all out of here? Is that, am I just get it in a different spot now? Maybe that's coming up under 10.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, we are getting to that point, and I will probably bring Steve Hirsch up to talk about your specific concerns.
Okay. Thank you.
We're starting, you can see under Section 5 that I just, Section 6 that I just talked about, which would allow a person when specifically authorized to move plants. The same piece, 8409 under Section 7, for the disposal as part of a harvest or control activity when specifically authorized. It's allowing people to move, for example, Eurasian water milfoil for disposal. You aren't supposed to move it otherwise. So these are just technical corrections there. I believe, Senator Kelash, some of your concerns probably start on Section 8 and moving forward in these subsequent pieces, talking about launching prohibitions, saying that a person may not place in the water or attempt to place water-related equipment, including, it goes on to list. And then in that section, we have a 21-day drying period. I should say, that's just adding, rather than prohibited, a watercraft or a trailer, we're expanding that to include water-related equipment. Getting at the issues here in Section 9, dealing with boat lifts and those types of machinery or equipment, I should say. What we found in the past year since we passed our first aquatic invasive species bill, the boats are a big risk, but any equipment that sits in water for a long time, really where the mussels will adhere to, present a larger danger. So we saw several infestations over the summer from people buying boat lifts from an infested lake and moving them into another lake. Our intention here on lines 5.17 to 5.19 is that a boat lift, dock, swim raft, or associated equipment that has been removed from the waters of a state infested with zebra mussels have to have a 21-day drying period. So it goes on to say mussels may not be placed in another water body for a minimum of 21 days. Is that, Senator Kelash, where your concern is?
It actually starts after that, so I just got ahead of myself. Sorry.
No problem. Section 10, this language will allow us to voluntarily, at the options of both parties, enter into a delegation agreement with the tribal or local government where inspection authority can be done, and then that they would need to assume all legal, financial, administrative responsibilities for inspection programs on some or all public waters within their jurisdictions. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, here's one of my
Senator
questions.
So
some of it has to do with, I'm not sure if, what I'm concerned about is one of the things like in, for example, line 7.8, where no reduction in capacity of hours or operation of public access and fees or reasonable travel times or reduction of, these kinds of things where the department is kind of said you're not going to slow down folks from getting into the water and that. And reasonable times is, for a fisherman, if you've got a 10-minute wait in prime fishing time, it's not reasonable. So what I'm concerned about is, I don't know if this stuff should be in statutes or in rulemaking. That would be a better way to put it, so that there's some flexibility based on the location of the inspection site and the number of cars that are backing up, et cetera. I don't know if this is adequately addressing it. Maybe it is. Maybe it's just fine. But it seems to me that there's some restrictions on here that that could be difficult to adhere to, especially as we get more aggressive at going after these invasive species.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulash, those are very good points that you raise. And this whole section I view as kind of a continued work in progress as we work with these local units of government to try to figure out what's the give and take going to be to have them do some of these things. Obviously, we can't be everywhere at every time. I think if you look at the key part of this is these issues will be addressed in the plan. So 7.6 and 7.7 says they have to submit a plan approved by the commissioner and it must address these issues. So talking about what is the reduction in capacity, our biggest fear on this is that we would delegate the authority to a local unit of government to do the inspections, but they wouldn't do the decontamination. So this boat owner that may be infested, they're saying it needs to, you can't go into this lake because you need to be contaminated. They'll just drive down the road till there's a lake with nobody looking and jump in that lake.
Yeah.
So, you know, I understand the concerns that some of these parties may have, and we need to continue working with them on it. But obviously we can't work, if think about Lake Mille Lacs in 169, if we were to delegate to either a local unit of government or a tribal government up there, we don't want them backing up traffic all the way to Elk River. You know, we have to do this in a sensible manner, right? So that would be addressed under our intentions in negotiations and in the plan development with that local unit of government.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, and I guess one of my concerns is that if we set up these inspection stations and then people back up, are we going to just they want to get into the lake? Are we just going to allow them to go without the inspections? Are we going to not force them to, you know, that kind of stuff? And it, putting it in statute kind of says that we're a reasonable time, so the person shouldn't have, to me it says that the person shouldn't have to wait a long time to get on the lake that they want, or if they're doing some cleanup after they get out of the lake. All of those things are kind of arbitrary, and it could, you know, 90% of the time there could be no problem, but all of a sudden it's the lake gets a it becomes a hot fishing lake, and you got three times as many boats as you've got the inspection station's capacity to deal with them. What happens is my question, and because it's in statute, I don't know if there's flexibility in here because it's in statute to allow you to adjust your strategy on that, and instead of through a rulemaking or process. That, I think that's my biggest concern, that I realize we can't be everywhere and that, but do we have the flexibility to do what we need to do on this with it in statutes instead of rulemaking?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulash, I believe the language here and the fact that the plan needs to address these issues, it's not saying it has to have X number of hours and things like that, does provide us the flexibility we need to work with each different local unit of government or watershed or whatever it's going to be. So I will evaluate that, and we'll talk with stakeholders. If that does seem to be a problem, we'll work on this bill moves forward.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
members.
Meyer, could I ask you a question on line 5.17? Can you explain, you've got a piece of equipment, a boat lift, say, and I'm selling it, so then a guy comes to buy it. He can't put it in his lake for 21 days. I understand that must be a right length of time, but what if he were to wash it off or decontaminate it? How would that work? Or couldn't it work?
Mr. Chairman, members, these pieces of equipment are very complex. They have a lot of cavities that you may or may not be able to clean properly. I mean, a boat lift is pipes and tubes and cables and pulleys, and from what we see, the best way to do that is to dry it out.
Okay.
Rather than try to decontaminate it. I mean, maybe into the future we can, but right now the most safest method of protection that we see is that mandatory dry out period.
This is our start, at least.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, moving forward, I believe we were on Section 10. We're talking about the requirements there, the elements. Section 11 gets into the civil penalties. This body passed the civil penalties as they are currently in this bill last session. Unfortunately, as we came out of conference committee, the penalties were reduced to half of what they are. So the numbers here have passed this committee and passed all committees and the Senate body at the levels they're at for these civil penalties. And actually, you look at how these are in relationships to other things that a person may do within the game and fish, violation statutes, and they are still pretty low. Taking a deer out of season or over limit of walleyes is sometimes more higher of a penalty than for infesting a whole lake with zebra mussels. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ringbritton.
Just for the committee's information, last year, Commissioner Myers, correct. There was some confusion last year, not confusion, but it was very clear to me what this was. This is a sanction. This is not a fee. And when we got to conference committee last year, it was still not quite cleared up. Some folks still had it in their mind that this was a fee, and this is actually a sanction. This is a fine. This is something that you're going to have to pay should you not abide by the rules. So if you're asked that question, I would just please emphasize that these are actually fines. They're not fees. So that's all I wanted to clear up for this section.
Pretty obvious. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr.
Meyer.
Members, moving forward, Section 12 on page 8, this language would enable for a combined trail use where it's warranted and safety can be maintained. You can see the language we're striking on 8.30, but not for motorized and non-motorized at the same time. There are certain segments of our trail system that can be for snowmobiling and cross-country skiing, for example, in certain areas of the state. This would just allow for these compatible uses to exist where by statute they would be able to. Section 13, Mr. Chairman and members. Okay, unless you want me to.
I think I have some questions about it later.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, just going back to civil citation pieces, you can see under 8.15 to 8.17, the author wanted me to make sure people were understanding that. You can see that it would be subject to twice the penalty amount if you have one or more convictions or final orders. Then those fines are deposited within. Part of those monies go to the local units of government. Part of them go back to the DNR. So making sure people do understand that. And this is a change, but again, it's if a person is careless enough to bring and introduce zebra mussels into a lake, we'll never get them out. I mean, we're trying to get some restitution for some folks with these boat lip cases, but that will pay for our treatment costs of the lakes because we had an immediate response and did some chemical treatments, but you can never restore that quality of a lake if an infestation occurs. So we need to, as Senator Ingebrigtsen was talking about, this is our first step. I think a lot of stakeholders think they should be a lot higher. So,
Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chairman, how much does the actual chemical treatment cost treat a lake?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman.
I just want to show that this is not an unreasonable
fee. Steve Hirsch up, and he can talk about those numbers. I believe we have an estimate of what our costs were just for treating certain small specific areas of the lakes up in Senator Ingebrigtsen's area.
Mr. Hirschhoff.
Mr. Chairman, Member Steve Hirsch, DNR Director of the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick. I don't know the cost per acre, but I know in the treatments we did of limited areas in these infestations we had last fall, I think the cost was running in the neighborhood of like $15,000 to $17,000. It might have been in the low 20s. We did three different treatments in each lake.
Expensive.
Okay. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now moving on, Section 12 is where we're at. I just talked about that. Section 13 and 14 really is kind of a technical change that we're pursuing within the Parks and Trails Division and going through our penalties and looking at the fines that we have on the court's payable list. We had penalties that were listed as misdemeanors in statute, but were only being charged as petty misdemeanors by the courts. So rather than have that discrepancy, we thought it'd be best to make sure that statute reflected what the actual penalty was being prescribed. So you can see, actually, this language has changed from the language a little bit that we had in the original bill because of some concerns dealing with the Outdoor Rec Act, but the basics of it lie on lines 9.9 to 9.10, where we're talking about laws promulgated in accordance with provisions of laws in 1923, Chapter 430, and we're just updating that according to Section 86, 8.06, which is the Outdoor Recreation Act, and they're guilty of a petty misdemeanor. Now, within the Outdoor Recreation Act lie the wildlife management areas, and the language from 9.12 to 9.19 deal with violations within a wildlife management area, because all of our game and fish violations are misdemeanors. So what we're trying to do is say that outside of game and fish violations on WMAs, if you violate a law within the park system or Outdoor Recreation Act system, it's a petty misdemeanor. So hopefully people, I haven't lost too many people on that technical correction, in our opinion. Section 14 also establishes that under the horse pass, that this provision is a petty misdemeanor rather than what it previously was listed as. Section 15, now we're back into the Aquatic Invasive Species Program. 15 and, section subdivisions 1, 2, 3, and 4 talk about an online training component. One of the big discussions we've had with our stakeholders is how do you make sure that people are educated on the transporting, cleaning, and things like that of boats, in particular from invasive species. And a suggestion that we had was to make people who are moving boats around get a special training. And to do that, we came up with this trailer decal suggestion, as other states do. I believe Montana or Wyoming have similar situation. Now, what we're asking for is a person who has a trailered boat, they would need to go online and get a decal, take a 15, 20-minute training, online training program. You would complete the test. Then you would be, what our vision is, a vendor will develop this, like our online hunter safety education program. You would pay a nominal fee to that vendor for the operation or for the development of that software. Pass the test, then you would get a decal sent to you to put on your trailer, so we would be able to make sure that you have been educated with invasive species training. The other alternatives to this would be to require every boat owner to require mandatory watercraft safety training, where a big component of that would be AIS-related components, but it was our idea that this would be a better start rather than requiring everybody over 12 years old to require that training. But some people think that's a better way to go as well. So,
Mr. Chair, just
Senator Keelash.
Quick question. I see on 10.17 the decals aren't transferable. So if you sell the trailer, it's not transferable to the next. How do you enforce that, or how is that? What I'm concerned about is somebody gets the decal that says they're trained and they're not. Is there any way of monitoring that, or is there any intention to? I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is kind of a work in progress for us on this one, and we do need to talk about that. One of the challenges we have are these trailers are now licensed for the lifetime of the trailer. So under law, when you sell your boat, the person who buys that now is supposed to transfer that title of the trailer, the registration of that trailer, to the new individual as well. I don't know the acceptability of that practice, but it is something we're trying to determine, and the best way to do that, probably working with DPS and education through our licensing as the renewals come up and things like that, the transfer. That would be one obvious place we could capture it, is when the title is transferred within our system. We can make sure that that happens.
Good. Thank you.
Moving forward, Mr. Chairman and members, this next section, Section 16, is related to that technical change with snowmobiles and ATVs, but dealing with boats, we're striking the word "the" and inserting "a" on lines 11.1. Section 17, what we're trying to do here is just provide an opportunity for a person. Just trying to go back to our fact sheet here. That if they fail to, if the person, you can see this is actually under section 14 of our fact sheet here. If a person fails to apply or to comply or show up into court, that their game and fish licenses would be suspended. So this is just another technical piece, a technical correction in that statute. Section 18, Mr. Chairman, it deals with VHS and the use of bait. Prescribed and adopted by the commissioner. This is a technical change. We did last ice fishing season prohibit the use of shiners. In particular, that Cisco's and Shiner's and smelt that came from Lake Superior, this language here would help us alleviate some of those problems. We now have a process where a bait processor can have their bait certified VHS-free. We test the waters, we give them a certification, and then they have to carry that. They have to put that within their packaging as well. So you can see the language on 12.3, unless the bait has been processed to inactivate VHS in a manner prescribed by rules and by the commissioner. Section 19, Mr. Chairman, is a report repealer. That is actually on page 14, 14.12 to 14.15. This is repealing a report requirement that the commissioner would have to report to the chairs on the outcome of our lands record management support. We can provide this information at any time to the legislature. Section 20 is a technical change. It's actually more than a technical change. It's changing an appropriation from the outdoor or legislative citizen commission on Minnesota resources that was appropriated in 2010. That will clarify that this appropriation, the basis of it is that we can charge or we can sell materials off of public or private property beginning on lines 15.22, and that the proceeds are spent to further the purposes of this appropriation by doing grants. This program is basically taking woody byproducts, buckthorn, other woody invasive species off of public and private lands, utilizing them for biomass, and then recycling those funds, putting them back into the project. We did discuss this within the Legislative Citizen Commission of Minnesota Resources. They are aware of the change here, Mr. Chairman. You can see Section 21 on 16.11 is a technical change to the Lake LaSalle statutes, and we're providing for some language that you can see on 16.15 to 16.17, dealing with hunting, fishing, and trapping of protected species during designated seasons and dogs under control for hunting purposes for regular hunting season. This is to allow us to be able to utilize those lands for hunting in accordance with state law. Section 22, Mr. Chairman, I believe come directly from the LCCMR. These are appropriation extensions that the commission, I believe, approved at their meeting in January. So that is contained in this bill now. Section, the repealers in Section 23, I believe, relate to specific reports that we're repealing, unless Mr. Knopf, those have changed at all in this issue. So this version, I should say. Mr. Chairman, that takes us into the lands pieces. There are one technical...
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor. Sorry. Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to point out that in your packet, along with the A1 amendment, you've got an appendix to it that has the language of all of the repealed sections, so you can actually see what's being repealed in the bill. So this includes all of those.
I can run through those really quickly, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Meyer.
The first one is our Natural Resources Asset Preservation and Replacement Report that, again, we provide this information through the capital budgeting process. The second one is a Capital Improvement Report that we're providing this information in the same manner as that first one. It's the third one is our Nursery and Tree Improvement Plan. This is an obsolete report now. 90.042 is a public involvement process that was on the books related to timber sales. And because of our public database, I mean, the internet and everything else that we have now, we feel this is a not needed report. 97.84742, Lifetime Fish and Wildlife Trust Fund reports. This information is contained within the Budget Oversight Committee, the Game and Fish Fund annual report we present to the legislature. And the last one here, the Stream Protection and Improvement Loan Program. There are no dollars remaining in this program, so there is no report left to do. So we thought it was time to repeal that report as well.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, moving into Article 2, road easements across state lands, you can see what we're trying to fix here on 17.9. We have the ability to provide leases on lands other than school trust fund lands to private individuals for access to property. What we are doing now is allowing us to do that with trust fund lands as well, generate more revenue for the trust. Currently, we do this through working with a local unit of government, such as a township. We feel it's just as easy to go with that individual. And then we're allowing that term to be 50 years if it is cross school trust fund land. The intentions of that section. Section 2 on page 18 allows us to expand our lease terms to 21 years. And for non-agricultural purposes, you can see for the removal of peat for non-agricultural purposes, we're including that language and just striking that the language related to peatlands for agricultural purposes on 18.21. And beginning at that point on, begins our land, actual land parcel pieces, Mr. Chairman. The first one, deletions from state parks. It's a small piece from Interstate Park in Chisago County. And if you look at our fact sheet that I handed out, it would be on page 3. It begins under, it says sections 4.4 through 11. So this section deletes 0.52 acres of land from Interstate State Park in Chisago County and 1.4 acres of land from McCarthy Beach State Park in St. Louis County. Then we go on to add 116 acres of land to Greenleaf Lake State Rec Area in Meeker County and 7.6 acres of land to the Iron Range OHV Recreation Area in Gilbert. The next section deletes 255.1 acres of land from that same facility up the Iron Range Off-Road Vehicle Rec Area in St. Louis County, including land not owned by the state and school trust land that was a buffer area out of that designation. State parks and state recreation boundaries have to be established by the statute, by the legislature, so that's why we're deleting these pieces here. Section 6 and 7 is just taking one piece out of Fond du Lac and putting it into the Nemadji. It's about 2,500 acres of land located in Carlton County. It really fits within the Nemadji rather than into the Fond du Lac. So rather than, we just thought this was the easiest way to do it. We aren't expanding or decreasing the size of the state forest. We're just changing the names of those areas. Section 8 authorizes a direct sale for less than value of 30.72 acres of land formerly known as the Black Dog Preserve SNA, Dakota County, I believe. Section 10 authorizes a direct sale of 1.4 acres in St. Louis County to resolve a trespass. And Section 11 authorizes a direct sale for less than market value for St. Louis County. Actually, Mr. Chairman, we needed to take that off. Cool. Good job. Thank you. That's not supposed to be in the bill, and it's not.
Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And maybe just a point of clarification, why the 21 years versus the 10? Just a real quick explanation for the committee on that. Page 18, lease term.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll bring up Kathy Lewis, and she can address that issue.
Hello, Missy Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kathy Lewis, Lands and Minerals, DNR. The provision in 9250 is to expand the term of leases for real estate, so it's for our miscellaneous leases and other real estate activities. About 2 years ago, the legislature amended Minnesota Statute Section 89.17, which authorizes real estate leasing for forestry lands. And so 9250 covers the rest of the lands that the DNR administers, and so this just makes sense that we can handle our real estate leasing program in a consistent fashion across land types, because leases often cross land types.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Lewis? Okay. Thank you. Ms. Mr. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, I also
excuse
have...
Excuse me, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Saxog, you have a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask Senator Ingebrigtsen that there's a lot of AIS stuff in this bill, and are you comfortable with the way that we're going to be handling it, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Saxog, am I comfortable with the... is it fair to say the question would be, is it am I comfortable with the enforcement part and the toughness of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. I think. Chair. And I was going to make some comments. Thanks for that question. We're going to get serious about enforcing these regulations. And talking with the enforcement officer here today, they more than tripled, I guess, or tripled their contacts or their arrests last year. So I think folks out there, at least what I'm hearing, are somewhat concerned, and I think Senator Kelash certainly was concerned about the backing up of traffic and things like that. But, you know, we have to use some good common sense. But the bottom line is, if we're serious about this stuff not moving around the state, we've got to get tough. And but you also got to work with the other body. And again, it's going to be a work in progress. I know there's some. Some questions about some of the sanctions, some of the tougher sanctions being too tough over there. But that's something that I think that we can work out, and we got through it last year. That's why I really emphasize the fine instead of the fee thing. I mean, if we're going to be serious about this, we got to let these people know that they're going to get fined out there if they're moving these things around the state, and that all of Minnesota is concerned about it. So. Kind of a long answer, but I think if we're going to step up and do it, we got to do it.
Good. Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebrigtsen, is this going to be held over? What's the intention on this bill?
Intention goes from here to Judiciary Public Safety.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of the questions I had on some of the new language, and Senator Kelash, thanks for bringing that up, the sticker on the trailer. You know, what do we do with people that come in from Iowa, Illinois, Indiana with their boats? I mean, are we going to stop them at the border of Minnesota and, hey, you got to stop in and have a 15-minute deal here and get a sticker? I mean, some of this stuff seems, I don't know if it's workable. I mean, I think they're good ideas, and we need to do everything we can to stop AIS, but they've got to be practical. I mean, have we thought through some of these things?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, thank you for those comments, because it is very serious. We're working right now. I just talked with the president of the resort campground in Hospitality, Minnesota, about opportunities to work with the resorts and campgrounds and all these private lake operations that have access sites to cabins and all these resorts. We need to work with them, make sure that they're doing self-inspecting. They're educating the people at their docks. It's our license proposal currently has a $3 invasive species surcharge on it. I don't know if that will last or not, but it's capturing revenue from those folks as well and educating them. As Senator Ingebrigtsen said, it is a work in progress, and for us, it's capturing these people coming into states. Is we need to work on it. You've seen our report that talks about the different management options. Inspecting every boat as it comes into the state isn't going to be workable. Inspecting every boat as it goes into or leaves a lake isn't going to be workable. But we need to change the hearts and minds of these recreational boaters and the people coming to our state to recreate, because we want to protect it and keep it the way it is. We don't want to have to deal with more infestations and things like that. So, you know, we're looking at new opportunities, new options. You'll hear from people that have some concerns about pieces within the bill. We want to work with them on it as well. But we want to have a strong program, because it is a new day, so to speak, in the battle against aquatic invasive species.
To that point, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I just wanted to point out there was some language that was added to this that the departments requested that was not in the original bill. If you look on 10.11 to 10.12, it does allow for temporary authorizations valid for 7 days, can be requested by persons that have not completed the required course of instruction. As Mr. Meyer mentioned, that may be a little bit of a work in progress. We do have until 2015 is the effective date on it. But that would allow for a person who's coming into the state to get a temporary
basically a waiver from the requirement for 7 days.
Senator Desick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To the point on the sticker, I think that's a big issue. But if they're coming in from another state to fish, don't they have to get a fishing license? Do they need a Minnesota fishing license, or do they come in with an Iowa fishing license? And then the follow-up question would be, if they have to get a license, can't we just put something on that? If they can do that online, can't we just put something on there saying, if you bring your own boat, you also need to, you know, view this video or some type of reminder to tell them? Because, again, if you get to, if it's 15 to 20,000 just to treat a small portion of the lake, and then you take that, and we just saw this whole video on this Cuna Lakes area, so it's not just an environment issue, because if that lake and those lakes start getting all full of milfoil and zebra mussels and they start dying, that's, you know, think of the economic impact of this area. So, I mean, I think we do need to be serious and creative.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Senator Dietzick, those are good questions. They would need to buy a Minnesota non-resident license, and there is an opportunity there, hopefully, to provide some education and training. And we're also recently attended a Explore Minnesota Tourism meeting, where working with our counterparts who are promoting tourism to make sure they're promoting invasive species training as well. So there's a lot of opportunities we're taking advantage of and working within the public and private sector to get the word out. And we will be looking at every available opportunity that's there. So,
Senator Gazelle, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, kind of along those lines, I can see how we could find a way to get people coming into our state that are fishing, because we can notify them when they get a license. But what about those that are just coming up here to boat? You know, they've got a speed boat. They're just going out to one of the lakes. And, you know, I know that we have to walk carefully through this. I just don't want to turn somebody away because they didn't know our rules, because they're going to be coming from, I don't know how many states people come to that have a boat, but I'll bet it's not small. So we've got to figure out a way through that too, for those that just aren't going to have one of those points of contact coming in to really know they were supposed to have done it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, great comments, and we do need to do that. And I think working with the private resort owners and every opportunity we have is our best approach at this point in time.
Senator Ingebretson.
Just real quickly, too, to Senator Carlson's question with regards to, is some of this stuff somewhat unreasonable? I think we have to prepare ourselves for other situations. I'm sure they're coming through your door, or calling you or emailing you about things such as fishing tournaments in the state of Minnesota. That's always been somewhat contentious for years, not even before the spread of invasive species. In fact, I think some of these fishing tournaments unjustly get the finger pointed at them for spreading milfoil, things like that. So there's already some talk, and some folks have been approaching us with regards to not allowing any of those tournaments on infected lakes, so they can't drive out of there with infected waters. So those are the kind of things that are going to be coming down the pike, folks. I mean, they're really going to get serious. And what's that going to do to a community? What's that going to do to economics? But be ready for those. You'll probably already, like me, you've heard some of that. So.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ingebrigtsen, I agree with you. And I've already seen the DNR, a lot of billboards around the state. You know, I think all of us have. And I would hope that people coming in from the outside, as Senator Gazelka was talking about, are going to see these things. I mean, we spent some money on those, and I think they're effective. So I think about them every time I see them. And so, I think you're taking the right steps, and we just got to keep on it. You're right.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, I do have one more witness, Mr. Forrester from the Minnesota Seasonal Rec Property Owners Coalition. You come up and testify a couple minutes.
Yep. Mr. Forrester, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forrester, Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. And we're here to speak specifically to the AIS sections of this bill. While we generally support many of the provisions in the agency bill, we have concerns with potential delegation of all responsibility and financial obligations to local units of government. The implications, as you've heard and reiterated, of infestations are grave. Property values diminish and local tax bases are reduced. Specifically, Section 9 on page 5, lines 5.13 to 5.15, we feel that zebra mussel designated waters should be included in addition to VHS waters. Zebra mussel veligers can survive at temperatures of 0 degrees Celsius and could be transported. Section 10, subdivision 2A, page 5, again gets to the language delegating authority to local units of government. And without a strong statewide approach and financial commitments from the state, local units will be forced to raise revenue in their jurisdictions and could create a patchwork of measures that create winners and losers in the fight against AIS in our shared public waters. In fact, we would favor the creation of a blue ribbon panel of experts from across the country to come and kind of help us put together a plan that makes sense for Minnesota, people who have had success elsewhere. We support the languages or the language on lines 6.11 to 6.15, increasing conservation officers' authority to stop and remove water-related equipment. We support the language in Section 11 regarding the penalties and the increase in fines. Lines 10.8 to 10.2. We question the wisdom of providing yet another free decal. Other states have grappled with this problem of boats that come in from out of state, and typically they charge a nominal fee as an educational requirement. And again, we stand committed to work with the DNR and all interested legislators going forward to ensure the preservation of our public water against these serious threats through thoughtful approaches and sound investments. Thank you.
Mr. Forrester, any questions for Mr. Forrester? Thank you. Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair and members, a lot of good discussion here. Of course, I don't think we're done with this by any stretch. I really appreciate Mr. Forrester as getting to be a familiar face around here and talking with the invasive species, and I know they've certainly been willing to work with us and the DNR on putting together these bills, and we'll certainly take their concerns as we move forward. But with that, unless there's any questions, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill, Senate File 1839, to pass as amended and sent to the Judiciary Public Safety Committee.
Senator Ingebretson moves the passage of Senate File 1839 as amended and recommended pass. Move to Judiciary and Public Safety. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Ayes have it. The bill does pass. Senator Dames, you're up next.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Senator Dames, and I'd like to introduce Senate File Number 2072. Senate File 2072 will amend Minnesota Statute 2010, Section 103G, 2241, Subdivision 1. What it amounts to is, if you go to the back of the bill, line 210, we will strike the words "that meet minimum state standards" under this chapter and sections. What it amounts to is, currently, if you are in the Farm Bill, the Federal Farm Bill, you have to qualify for the Swamp Buster Bill. And if you qualify for the Swamp Buster Bill, that should meet the needs so that you would not have to file a replacement plan for wetlands. With that said, I have two testifiers here. I have Jerry Schoenfeldt and Bruce Claven, and I would like to turn it over to Jerry for his input on this bill.
Mr. Schoenfeldt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeldt. I work with the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. I think probably the quickest way for you to get a sense of all of this is if I think in your packets you have got a sheet that shows Fish and Wildlife Service interagency activities at the very top.
When farmers, since 1985, so it's been almost 27 years, there has been a swamp buster provision in the Federal Farm Act. And what it basically has done is to say that if you're going to participate in the Federal Farm Bill, that you cannot drain soils that are considered wetlands. And so if you read 4.2, Fish and Wildlife Service, I think it'll explain to you exactly what the swamp buster provision is on the federal level. Food Security Act of 1985 contains several provisions. These provisions are often referred to as the swamp buster provisions. State that a person will be ineligible for all or a portion of certain USDA program benefits, including loans, subsidies, crop insurance, and price support programs, if the person produces an agricultural commodity on a wetland that was converted after December 23, 1985. A person will also be ineligible if, after November 28, 1990, the person converts a wetland by draining, dredging, filling, leveling, removing woody vegetation or other means for the purpose or to affect the effect of making possible the production of an agricultural commodity. And it goes on. The point simply being, the swamp buster really does prohibit the draining of wetlands if you are in the federal farm program. Now, if you're not in the federal farm program, then you would still be under the provisions of the state WACA law, the state wetland law. And really, that's about the simplicity of the bill. Where it came from was the fact that we had farmers, we have a lot of farmers that have believed that they were protected in a sense because they had participated in the federal farm program. The federal swamp buster provisions prohibit them from draining wetlands, and so therefore they would not be able to do that. Now, there is a way you can drain a wetland. That's through a mitigation process, which is also available on the state level. But they believe that, and then recently, I think even, to be honest with you, even I think Mr. Clevin and myself kind of believe that, and part of the reason for that was because when this law was put into effect, if you take a look at the changes that we're proposing, in 2007, the provision that's being deleted was a provision that basically at that time the agencies said, well, we have some concerns, and so we're going to sit down together between the Pollution Control Agency and Bowser and so forth, and we're going to work this out, and then we'll, if you're under the Federal Farm Act at that point, we will be, you'll be approved. That never occurred. The agencies never came forth with that agreement. So because of that, we're coming back to you today and say, let's put it into state law. As I said, this has been about 27 years that this has been in effect on the federal level. And one of the arguments back then and probably still today is the fact that, yes, the federal law can change. And, yes, it can. But the swamp buster provisions in the code has been there quite some time. And if they do change, it is true that you may have to come back here and revisit this issue. But quite frankly, that's what we do with a lot of bills around here that are related to federal policy. So, Mr. Chairman, that's basically what it does, is to say that if you're covered under the Federal Swamp Buster Act because you're participating in the Federal Farm Act programs, then you are not you don't have to go any further. You don't have to take a second step and check with the state agency as well.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Schoenfield? Okay, Mr. Clevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Off the record, Bruce Clevin, I represent the Minnesota wheat growers and sugar beet growers and some others. I don't have much to add. Jerry laid it out. It's really that simple. And I do want to let the members know and the audience members know this is not an effort to add drainage or do additional drainage simply because Swamp Buster prohibits that. This is not a camel's nose under the tent. This is the way we always thought we had it. In fact, Farm Bill references used to be in the state law, the 1985 Farm Bill, 1990, 96, 2002. Senator Langseth, you're probably the only one here that would have been back when this was originally passed in 91, and those references were in that at that time. So we've always operated on that assumption that if you follow the Farm Bill, you're good to go. The Farm Bill reference has been taken out, and that's why we thought it would be better to go back to the Swamp Buster Code, Title 16 on the page that Senator Dames referenced, and simply say if you're in compliance with Swamp Buster, you're good to go, and you don't need to do the state analysis. And that's the bill.
Mr. Senator Dames, any questions first off for Any of the testifiers? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I believe there are two other testifiers, John Jasky and Lance Ness, so if we could bring them to the table.
Okay. Mr. Jansky, want to start out?
I think he wanted me to go first.
Okay, Mr. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lance Ness, president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. We have a packet, a letter in your packet for you, and I'll just be quick, Mr. Chairman. So, dear members, the Wetland Conservation Act's goal is no net loss. That is a state policy. We believe this bill undermines that. Allowing additional exemptions for more wetland drainage will result in increases losses, not no net loss. Under this provision, there would be no way to track or record these exemptions, so losses would be unknown and unaccounted for. An exact opposite result of state policy of no net loss. As more and more waters of the state are being impaired and flood damages increase, we believe now is the wrong time to liberalize our fundamental state law for wetland protection. There was a comprehensive public process 2 years ago that was set to make a democratic process of this and produced a balanced set of rules the way we see it. And finally, one of the most important, if not the most important, and overlooked and underappreciated measures of progress that has been made in Minnesota wetlands protection is that a significant culture shift that has occurred. This shift is due in mostly part to work of grassroots organizations that are being led by citizens. We have gone from a cultural climate of apathy and denial to one today of much greater understanding, more citizen participation, and a desire for continued actions to improve conditions in our lakes, rivers, and wetland systems for the benefit of us all. We would respectfully ask that the bills be tabled so our citizens have a better understanding of the effects of this legislation. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Ness? Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Mr. Ness, it seems like we're doing cross purposes here. On the one hand, we're looking for an easier way to drain land, and with the Outdoor Heritage Fund and clean water stuff, we're trying to create more potholes for ducks and wildlife. And is that what we're doing here? Is that what we're trying to do? So a guy could fill in his pothole and take this wetland off the circuit, and we come back a few years later, and Ducks Unlimited puts the pothole back in, and he gets paid twice for whatever.
I wouldn't say
Mr. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, I would say it's I couldn't comment exactly if that's the case.
Yeah.
But I would say that the case is yes, we have moved ahead in restoring wetlands. We put many thousands of dollars, private groups such as Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Waterfall, Pheasants Forever, restore wetlands all the time. So to see a bill that, in fact, increases or perhaps encourages further wetland loss would be cross purposes for us.
Mr. Ness, I think this is about, they're saying it's about reporting, but if you're reporting it to a state agency that's responsible for wetlands and, someone's interested in taking a wetland out in an area where we're trying to establish more wetlands, the agency should know about it so we can, there's other ways to deal with it other than, the farmer can get paid or whatever through a different program to help make that work. Is that reasonable? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash. Yes, we're trying to achieve a policy of no net loss, and the Department of Natural Resources and Bowser keeps track of a lot of those things. I think they have a report just about to come out very shortly to indicate where we're at with wetland losses. And someone from the department perhaps speak to that, but that's very close, I think, into fruition and knowing exactly where we stand with no net loss at this point.
Senator Langsat.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm a farmer, and there are a lot of these that are designated as wetlands that are dry most of the year. And it just really makes it very, very difficult for the farmer to farm. It's a dip in a field, and yet it's classified as a wetland. And so I think that we need a little common sense here. I'm not sure just how this language really affects it, but I do know that's a pet peeve among farmers is when you've got something called a wetland that's dry most of the year. It may be wet in the spring, and they aren't able to drain it. So I don't know. It's just a comment, and I think some of these areas that are designated as wetlands really shouldn't be declared wetlands.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator James, so will we be relying on federal enforcement as well?
Mr. Chair, it's Senator Higgins. If you qualify for the farm program, you have to follow the rules of Swamp Buster. So if you're following the Swamp Buster rules, those rules, there's no reason to be following state and Swamp Buster rules. The federal government has a very good control of that. If you don't follow Swamp Buster rules, you're going to lose your farm program aid. And the farmers that are in farm programs don't want to lose their farm program payments. So as far as if you question if we're under their responsibility for jurisdiction to carry it out, the Farm Bill does a pretty good job of that, because if you don't qualify or don't follow the rules of Swamp Buster, you're not going to get your farm payments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Sorry,
ma'am.
James. So are there federal investigators or inspectors who come and look at a farmer's property to see if he is going by the Swamp Busters, or is this all kind of on a farmer's word?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I do not have an official answer for that. My assumption is that the farm associations that handle it on a federal basis, that handle a program in your local community, would have that authority, just like they do to make sure that you're following all the other rules and regulations required in a farm program.
I've been told the NRCS handles that.
And that would be what?
Well, either one, or the FSA.
Well, that's nice, but what the heck are those acronyms?
You want to give those? We're probably looking them up.
Services.
Yeah. Agency. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I could probably answer that.
Yes, thank you. Go ahead, Mr.
John Jasky, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. We're the state agency responsible for implementing the State Wetland Conservation Act, and to answer Senator Higgins' question about the acronyms, those are the two agencies of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is the technical entity, and the Farm Service Agency, which is the agency that provides the farm payments to producers who are in the program, as Senator Dames mentioned. And it would be their collective responsibility to make sure those conditions are complied with.
So,
Senator Higgins.
Was Senator Dames right? My question still stands. So does somebody actually come out and investigate or inspect to see whether somebody is complying with Swamp Buster?
Mr. Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, the answer is generally yes. It depends on how they find the information. Now, typically, if someone files a complaint, an investigation is triggered. And currently, it's in a combination of state, local, and federal resources that are brought to that equation, depending on which one has the most primacy in terms of jurisdiction. They will work out a solution for that landowner. As Senator Dames mentioned, the Swamp Buster program isn't a wetland regulatory program. It's more of a condition of being compliant with other things that allow you to receive federal farm program payments through, you know, whatever programs those might be. Some are conservation, some are payments for producing commodities and so forth, and we probably don't want to go into all of that, but many and most producers in Minnesota and across the country are in the program currently. As I think one of the earlier testifiers indicated, that federal law gets renewed every 5 years, and we expect that that'll happen either this coming year or early next year. So there'll be a new federal farm bill, new statute written. We don't know exactly what it will say, and we'll have to wait and see what it comes up with. But that is one of the things that I wanted to mention in my testimony as one of the points to think about as far as whether this bill can be improved or whether it's needed at all. So,
okay. Senator Kielash?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jasky, I think that was my question is, what problems does this bill solve, and what kind of problems could it create for your agency and the ability to monitor wetlands?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, if you don't mind, I'll just kind of go through my couple of points, and then I'll see if that answers your question. Really, 3 points, you know, is first of all, as the previous testifiers indicated, we did have a time in the past when we did have the ability to coordinate these two programs through the information that was shareable between the federal and state agencies. Unfortunately or fortunately, but regardless, it happened, and I think it was 2000, and that farm bill was passed, there was a data privacy provision put on all that information that each producer has about their farm, including the kinds of things that are designated on their property. That inability to share information is the biggest challenge we've faced in the last several years. And as one of the testifiers indicated, the language that's being stricken here was not operational because there was no ability to get the information to make the decisions. We've worked on two workarounds to that. One is we have an agreement with the USDA and NRCS to administer these programs in joint fashion whenever possible. And secondly, we have a contribution agreement or an actually administrative contract to do the work together. So we've actually accomplished a good bit of the intent that was provided in the law as it was indicated in 2007. So that's the main point, is we don't have the ability to share information except through the landowner, and if the bill is going to continue forward, we'd like to make some suggestions about how to make sure that that can happen. I think that's in the best interest of everyone. And then finally, you know, this is more of a, I guess, a policy question about structure. You know, whether referring to a federal law that's going to be potentially amended in the near future is the way to handle it, or whether we pursue it through a state approach that tries to do its best to replicate that as a question of you know, your style and how you want to write a statute. But either one can work. But as was indicated, we'll likely be back here again trying to update things if, in fact, the federal law makes modifications to this citation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to table this until they can work out their differences and maybe get the language right on the federal versus state law, and that I just think it's not quite ready, and so I'd like to move that we table it.
Okay, that's a non-debatable motion. Mm-hmm. Everybody understand the motion? All in favor of Senator Kelash tabling Senate File 2072? Say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign?
Nay.
No.
I don't believe it passed.
Division?
So, the division has been requested by Senator Higgins. Those in favor of tabling Senate File 2072, indicate by raising your hand. And those not wishing to table, please raise your hand. The motion does not prevail. Continue, Mr. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that the bill be moved and laid, possible laid over for inclusion in the Environmental and Natural Resources Policy Bill.
Senator Dames moves that Senate File 2072, and I don't believe there was any amendments, were there, to be held over, be laid over for possible inclusion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign?
No.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
So we didn't table it, we just laid it over.
Glad to take action. We wouldn't have to. We like to take lots of action. In fact, we pass bills sometimes and we don't even hear. That's a little over the top. Yes. Well, that's not going to happen again. Senate File 2042, Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Senator Dames, Senate File number 2042, and I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Members, I'm not sure whether you have that or not. It's going to be handed out here shortly. Okay. Mr. Knopf, when this is being handed out, maybe you could describe the A1 amendment offered by Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know if you wanted to treat this as an author's amendment. I mean, I can explain the amendment, but it's a matter of timing. You may want to just adopt it first.
Certainly.
This replaces Section 2 in the bill.
Senator Dames renews his motion to the A1 amendment to Senate File 2042. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. Bill's in order. Senator Dames, Mr. Knopf, would you... are there any questions on the amendment? Okay. Senator Dames.
With that said, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Jaski to go through the portions of the Senate File 2042.
Mr. Jaski, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to see if someone can hand me a copy of the amendment, so when I get to that section, I can maybe comment on it. But let me just go up for the other sections first, then, Mr. Chairman, if that's okay. This is not an agency bill, but these sections 1, 3, and 4 are something that we believe are okay. I'll try and just explain what they're doing, and then we can come back to the Section 2, I guess. I'll have to look at that a little more carefully. So Section 1, this language here would provide some discretion. I think it's practical to allow a deed restriction to be placed on property in ag land areas when that land is going to be potentially converted to non-ag land in the 10-year into the future if there's been a wetland impact on it. If not, then we wouldn't need that deed restriction. I think this allows us to, you know, let local governments decide that. That's the way I interpret this, and I think that makes some sense. It isn't necessary in every case, but in some cases it is, and they will make that decision and file that recording if required or needed. Section 3, which is on page 6 of the bill. The bottom of page 6, this language... We have in Minnesota a wetland banking program that some of you are familiar with, which allows persons or organizations to establish credits and then sell those or trade those to those who are looking to acquire them if they have to drain or fill a wetland somewhere and they've been approved to do that under a federal or state or a local permit. This language would provide some additional options to use that approach of using a wetland bank by trading credits from one party to another. And this is probably related to a federal rule that's been recently enacted that promotes wetland banking as the preferred alternative for wetland mitigation or offsetting rather than having people try and do it themselves. They've been looking at the science of the evaluation on wetland impacts and determined that the better sites end up being those that are organized and handled and administered systematically through a bank than when we have people doing them kind of one by one. So this language would provide some additional options that, and the way I read it, it's permissive, so it doesn't require these things, but would allow them to go forward when it made sense to do that. And it would be in coordination with a number of other organizations that are part of that whole wetland administration and banking system. And then on page 7, the language, Section 4, actually this is very similar to language that's currently in law in 103G.127 that was created 20-some years ago. The Federal Clean Water Act provides for the option to delegate, you know, parts of their programs to states. And, of course, in Minnesota, the Pollution Control Agency is the primary agency that handles that water quality delegation. This is a specific provision of that, which is the Federal 404 program, which is what the Corps of Engineers administers across the country. And this would allow, in essence, a transfer from the Corps of Engineers to the state of Minnesota to carry out that program and in essence, have a unified permitting system. In Michigan and in New Jersey, this has been done previously. But if it's done comprehensively, and you see two things in here I think are important to point out. One is on line 7.7. It's a may, so it's permissive. It's not requiring any of this to be done, but setting up the opportunity if it presents itself to the state. And then on line 7.10, this is a key distinction from the language that was previously in statute in the other section, and that is it says in whole or part, because one of the things that I've become aware of recently is that the federal government is looking at partial delegation, and that might make sense in Minnesota. We've already worked out agreements through other options that have worked quite well. I don't know if that's viable or not. We'd have to wait and see, but certainly the entire program being delegated is very unlikely. It'd be very expensive. We estimate somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 million. Now, that's not required here because we've got an option here of May, but so the language is acceptable. It's probably not going to be used in the immediate future, but it would set up the possibility down the road, in particular for a partial assumption. Well, then banking might be one of those partial payments that would be delegated. With that, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll look at the amendment. Quick scan it, if you don't mind, just to see what it says. This is a de minimis exemption, which is the just a little bit of background. This exemption is the one that allows, you know, call it a free impact to a well and without any mitigation, without replacement. And so the language that's being stricken here is actually looks like it separates the exemption into two categories. Okay, now I'm back on track here. We have in Minnesota basically three zones where this exemption applies geography-wise, from northeastern Minnesota to central Minnesota to south and western Minnesota, and that reflects the amount of wetland that is in those areas, obviously very different landscapes. And so we have regional differences reflected in these numbers that are on lines 1.8, 1.11, and 1.14. That's historic. It's been negotiated many years in the past. We also have three different zones, and that's what this exemption, which, you know, once was somewhat simple, is no longer so simple. And it looks like the goal here is to try and make it simpler. You'd have a area that's non-shoreland area, then you'd have an area that's within the shoreland. And within the shoreland, you'd have a more restrictive set of conditions, which is currently also the case. And then you have this area that's within the shoreland, which is the building setback zone, which is the area between the lake and the building sites. And I'm trying to do my best to look at the numbers here, but it looks to me like we create these zones. I think that's probably helpful to understand where you're at and how to determine what your exemption amount is. It looks like it's pretty close to what we have now, but organized in a different and hopefully more understandable fashion. But I'm going to have to make sure I can check those numbers before I can comment on it, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Knopf, make some comments with regards to the amendment as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, I did send around a table that kind of shows you where you're at, depending on where, if you're outside the shoreland area, if you're in a greater than 80% area. And just for the committee members' edification here, I want to point out, when we talk about greater than 80%, 50 to 80%, or less than 50%, we're talking about that's the number or the percentage of pre-settlement wetlands that you have. The board has a map and the rules that basically designates counties as to whether they're 80%, 50 to 80%, or less than 50%. And so this chart kind of shows you where you're at, depending on where you're at, how many square feet of wetland that you can disturb without having a replacement plan. And you can see in the language, current law also has a different provision for the metropolitan area. We've gotten rid of that, and then it. But so now we're dealing with the greater than 80%, 50%, less than 50. When you're outside the shoreland zone, but when you're within, we're talking about areas outside the building setback. You've got the 400 square feet for types 1, 2, 6, or 7, and then within the shoreland setback or building setback, you'd have all types would be 100 square feet. So this is kind of simplifying and revamping the de minimis levels based on where you are in the state, but it doesn't separate out the 11 county metropolitan area and the rest of the state like it did before. So you can basically see on there if there are any questions about how that's set up. It is a change from current law.
Mr. Jasky, comments?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's accurate. I'm looking, actually, the chart is very helpful. And I'm also pulling out of my file the chart from the existing law, the way it was written. And, I mean, I can't give you this close and personal, but it is simpler. Is still complex in terms of the way Mr. Knopf describes it, but it is simpler, right? And it looks like the protection levels are, you know, not exactly the same, but they're overall, you know, fairly close. And so unless there's a little bit more time to look at it, I think it's certainly an improvement over what was in the original bill, Mr. Chair, and we believe that that's a step forward with this amendment.
Okay. Any questions so far, members? Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is just a, and it might be explained somewhere else in here, but on page 1, line 1.14, and then it's referred to throughout the rest of the bill. It talks about approved by the board. Who's the board? It's referred throughout.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, it's the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Okay.
The board that Mr. Jasky is executive director for.
Should that be referenced and then put, you know, quote, come aboard?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, as the way we generally draft statutes, when they're in the chapter, if the board is defined in the chapter, then we use it throughout this board.
Any further questions so far?
I just want them to say Bowser more often.
Bowser. Mr. Dames, we also have Gary Botzik. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Botzik.
Mr. Chairman, it is indeed Gary Botzik, Minnesota Conservation Federation, and I'm pinch hitting for Lance Ness after that last go around. He asked to be relieved of his duty, so I'm here to take the heat for the rest of the hour.
Was the other chair really tough on him?
That tough one.
Yeah, no, he was fine. He'll get over it, Mr.
Well,
Chair.
He's still there. He's still breathing.
He's fine.
Well, welcome, Mr.
Chairman, thank you. I was here in 91 with Senator Langseth when this law was passed. Representative Marcus Marsh carried it in the House. Senator Langseth or Greg Knopf can tell us who the Senate author was, but I can't remember.
Mr. Chair?
It's too long.
Senator Davis, okay.
No, Mr. Chair, it depends on, well, yes. It was Senator Davis that carried this bill. I think the companion, though, was Senator Merriam. There were two bills that were introduced.
Okay, thank you for that history lesson. We all could learn something. Just this afternoon, I had a chance to go through this Minnesota Wetlands Protection Report, 2006, done by the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I'd encourage you all to read this. I think NCEA has extra copies. But for the new senators, here's your Senator Langseth. You know these too, but 8 different types of wetlands in Minnesota, all the way from the flooded plain to the bog, which is. You know, these are very controversial as to whether these are wet spots or dry spots, depending on which way the farmer's going with his plow, and that's why the controversy around this. This thing has been amended many times. We don't think from the conservation and environmental perspective ever to the positive side, other than we've given up every time we amend this, except for 2007, which was addressed or mentioned in the last bill. This is problematic since... before the state, when the state, Minnesota became a state in 1858, we've lost over half of our wetlands in Minnesota. In the agricultural areas of southern Minnesota, over 90% of our wetlands have been drained. And we feel that there's also been a big change, I think, in the last 10 years with the Clean Water Act at the federal level and all of our emphasis and now a dedicated funding for clean water in Minnesota. We're finding that wetlands have a even another defined purpose. They've always been good for ducks. They've always been good for habitat and filtration. But we're finding that they're very good for filtration. And a lot of the TMDLs that are being done now for our lakes and streams, we're finding that these wetlands that happen to be conveniently located to a lake or a water body can be used and should be used as filtration and holding not only holding the water back, but also filtrating it before that water gets into a lake or stream. So that's very important. So this is a dynamic law. I understand the need to look at it and allow farmers to farm and developers to develop, but let's also not lose track of what the original intent of this Act of 1991 was to protect the less than 50% of the wetlands that we have left since pre-settlement, pre-state days. So we'd urge caution and... I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Members, any questions of Mr. Botzik? Senator Saxlock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Botzik, I think some of us are familiar with the federal government getting out of the CRP program. Could you give us a little rundown on that and what it might mean to our clean water and our wetlands?
Mr. Botzik.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator. Yes, we're concerned about the next federal farm bill. Giving another example, transportation bills have been 6 years. We can't get a transportation bill passed out there. Continuing resolutions, farm bills are one step behind that. We may be looking at a 1 year or a 2 year farm bill rather than a 5 or a 6 year farm bill. There's no guarantee that Swamp Buster will be
will be there, or funded properly. The walk-in program, as you know, that Representative Peterson got for us, is will not be funded again. So if we can't find money at the state level, we're going to lose all that progress we made in walk-in, which is on private lands, as you know. As it relates to conservation, yeah, we are preparing ourselves for cuts in the conservation section of the Farm Bill, which allows more and more of these CRP lands to drop out of federal protection. We hope and think that, in fact, Senator Dames, thank you very much, is carrying the RIM bonding bill, $25 million, which will be a safety net to catch some of those most water-intense wetlands that will be falling out of the federal program. So this is not a good time to be backing out of strong wetlands policy in Minnesota. We're going to need that as the federal farm bill comes together or doesn't come together and ends up in a continuing resolution. So I couldn't begin to predict my Republican friends out there as to what's going to pass, but it doesn't look good right now.
Mr. Botsek, the governor's got some wetland mitigation bonding in his particular proposal, doesn't he? Doesn't it address some of your concerns?
Mr. Chairman, the governor chose not to put the $13.1 million in, this is from roads, local roads, that would mitigate wetlands as county, local governments, particularly counties, put in driveways and other turnout areas for allowing a person to build out back in the woods, et cetera. That would provide state money to the counties and or cities and townships to pay for that mitigation that would have to occur under WACA. So that, we are pushing that bill. I'm trying to think who is carrying that for us in the Senate. I know Senator, Mr. Chairman, you're on it.
Senator Gimsey, I believe.
Yeah. Gimsey, yeah. Senator Gimsey is carrying that, and we hope that we'll end up in a Senate bonding bill in the near future. That is a Bowser, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, a Bowser recommendation of $13.1 million.
Good. Mr. Jaski, a question that I have with regards to Mr. Botsek's concerns. Is this bill good? You mentioned that this makes it a little more clear, I guess. Maybe that's what you used. Can you explain that a little bit more to the committee?
Mr. Chairman, members, specific to Section 2, as I said, the other three sections, you know, we don't see a significant problem with any of those three as written. I just saw this amendment, and like I said, it looks like it's certainly improved over what was in the original bill. Need to look at it a little bit more carefully to make a final judgment about whether it's the equivalent of what we currently have in law in terms of protection. I do agree that it has improved the understanding of how this exemption would be applied. It's made it improved in terms of understanding it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Members, any further questions? If not, Senator Dames, I understand we're going to have to bring this to the
State Government and Innovation,
State
I believe.
Government and Innovations. So, Senator Dames.
I'll move that Senate File 2042 be passed and moved
as amended.
As amended to State Government and Innovation.
Okay. Members, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Both same sign?
No.
Okay, carries. Thank you, Senator Dames and testifiers. Nothing else before the committee? The committee stands adjourned.
Thank you.
Oh, I know. I think the other one is